I'm spying on Mr. Kellner in his living room, looking in through a corner of the window, wondering if I should go to him, let him know about Marla. He's lighting a candle on a cupcake, wearing a sad smile. The cupcake is set on the coffee table next to a framed photo of what I figure has to be his wife.
You know what today is, stupid bird? It's the day I miss her the most. Happy birthday, Janice.
Stupid bird. Happy birthday.
No, I can't tell Mr. Kellner or Lucinda. If they know I'm in danger, they'll definitely bring the police into it, and I'm just not ready for that yet. But for the first time, I think I can actually imagine a time when I will be. Maybe Lucinda's right. Maybe everyone's got someone who'd miss them if they were gone. Even me.
It's gotta be around here somewhere.
Keep it down, asshole.
We had to come out tonight in the damn rain. I don't know why we're looking for this damn phone anyway. It's lost.
Were you not listening before?
Yeah, I heard you. Marla's mom has been calling her phone, and someone picked up. So what?
So what? So we figured we buried Marla's phone with her, but somebody's got the phone. We don't know what the bitch had on it.
You made her put it away, Cerise.
Besides, if somebody found it and took off with it, what are we gonna find here?
We know the little bitch took pics of us when we first got here that night. That's all it'll take to put us right in the middle of this shit.
You don't think it was killing her in the first place that got us into this?
I wanted Willie back. I would have done anything.
Yeah, but it didn't work, did it? Willie's still dead, and we're all gonna go down for what you did.
So damn stupid, forgetting about that phone. Wouldn't tell her mom's mentioned someone picking up that I really started thinking about it.
Come on, Cerise. You were just as freaked as the rest of us. You play at being the Ice Queen, but you forget. We known you almost all your life. Once the killing was done, once we got blood on our hands, that was different than just talking about it. We all lost our shit for a while there.
Let's just make sure we don't burn for it.
Here's the grave. If she dropped it, it can't be far. Gotta say, though, if someone picked up that phone, it's long gone.
You don't know that. We gotta at least look.
We searched this whole area. It ain't here. We gotta start thinking about who might have found it.
The caretaker. Maybe the guys who cut the grass and shit.
Rain's coming down harder. This ain't working. Hey, you know, if it's anywhere around here, the best way to find a cell phone is to call it.
I'm asleep in my crypt when it happens.
Oh, shit! No, 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 shut up!
Before I killed it, the phone ID'd Esteban. He knows Marla's dead. So why the hell is Esteban calling her? Unless they're...
Hey, I think it was up this way.
Call it again.
I slip outside. I've muted the ringer on Marla's phone, and I have it with me. I can see them. They're not far from my crypt. They're facing mostly away from me as I dart between headstones. A flashlight beam sweeps nearby.
Over there! There's someone else here!
Crap! I duck behind the angel statue. More flashlights scan the area around me. I can't keep this up all night, but if I use Marla's phone to call the cops, they'll be all over the cemetery. I'm afraid to turn in Marla's killer because I'm afraid my own might find me. Irony sucks.
Oh! What the hell? Hello? Marla?
What did she say?
She said we gotta get out of here.
Oh, Jesus Christ. You idiot. It's not Marla's ghost. It's just some bitch calling you from her phone. Go find her!
Uh-oh. That definitely didn't work out like I planned. Even a life in a cemetery is better than no life at all.
You're not gonna get away, bitch. I can smell you.
She's gonna come around the stone and see me. I've gotta move.
Get the bitch!
Esteban swings his flashlight around as I run past him. It clips me in the shoulder, hard, but I keep moving and dive into the shadows.
I think you got her, Esteban. Look everywhere. She's close.
God, I don't want to die like this.
All right, assholes. Get out of here the way you got in, because the cops are coming.
I peek around the corner. Mr. Kellner has a big lantern-type flashlight and a baseball bat cocked over his shoulder.
I don't know you. Let's keep it that way.
Shit! Let's go!
He watches them head for the wall, making sure they're really gone. Then he kills the flashlight and turns back, addressing the darkness.
Okay, little ghost. I know you don't want to talk to me, but I hope you're not hurt.
Thanks, Mr. Kellner. You're a good guy.
Okay, have it your way. But you need anything, you come see me. You don't need to say a word.
Holding my aching shoulder, I start dragging my sorry self home.
Oh, by the way, I didn't really call the police. I should call child services, you know. But I grew up in those homes, and I figure you're better off here. At least I can keep an eye on you. When the time comes and you're ready to face the world, you let me know. I'll help the best I can. But take your time, darling. No rush. I figure if you gotta live in a cemetery, home must be pretty bad.
Back in my crypt condo, I pull my shirt sleeve up over my shoulder. It hurts like hell, and it's starting to turn purple. Enough of this. Just enough. I've got the umbrella Lucinda gave me a while ago now as I make my way through the cemetery, thinking. I keep looking over my shoulder to make sure no one's following me. I come to Willie's grave. I'm not sure why I'm here, really, but I have to do something. The ground here is absolutely saturated, and some of the loose topsoil is washed away. I can see the shadow of something jutting out from the ground. Marla's hand.
It's time.
I fall to my knees, losing the umbrella, and here come the memories. Marla, about 11, pushing Willie into a YMCA pool.
Whoa! You! I'm gonna get you, girl!
Marla in the upstairs window of their row house, spying on Willie and Cerise as they make out on the front steps.
I know, girl, I know.
Cerise hugging Marla at Willie's funeral, while Esteban looks on.
We need you to die.
Earth to earth, ashes to ashes.
A young girl with red hair.
Dust to dust.
Dressed for a funeral on a sunny day, with a flower in her hand. A large male hand rests on her shoulder.
Hold still, bitch.
Some of those memories, they weren't Marla's. It's morning, and the sun is shining. Just a few small clouds. Mr. Kellner's off on an errand of some kind. I stayed up half the night hoping more of my memories would come back. I figure something about having Marla in here with me must have shaken them loose. I want them back. I want to know who I really am, who I used to be. But at the same time, I'm afraid of what I'll learn. But none of that matters today. My memories will come back, or they won't. Today is for Marla. I stand in the street in front of the cemetery gates, looking up at the iron letters of Dunhill Cemetery in the arch above me. Marla's cell phone is in my hands. A funeral procession goes past me into the cemetery, sparking just a little flicker of one of the memories I recalled last night. A funeral. But I wasn't crashing that one. I remember the pain of it. Unbearable. The man with his hand on my shoulder. Was that my father? Was the funeral for my mother? I don't remember. And part of me is glad. I don't want the pain. I stand in front of Willie's grave.
The ground is mostly dry now, but Marla's hand is still sticking out. I make a few more moves. And the deed is done. I stand up, slipping both empty hands into my jacket pockets.
Oh my God, you're her, aren't you?
Inside me, I can feel Marla's fear and betrayal. These were her big brother's closest friends.
Trey, I got her! The bitch is over here!
And suddenly, I'm done being afraid.
Shit! She's running for it! Trey, get your ass over here!
I head for the tree that gets me over the rear wall to Lucinda's house. Trey is sprinting to head me off. I leap over a headstone like an Olympic sprinter over a hurdle.
No point in running, bitch! No exit back this way.
Not even close.
Damn it!
Where is she?
She's going over the back wall on the... What is it? Chestnut Street? You got her? What the hell? I got all these texts. Oh, shit.
Right about now, everyone in Marla's address book is getting the same text messages with attachments.
OMG, Anna. Look at this.
You sick freaks.
Anita. I know where our daughter is.
There! She's right there!
I see her.
We gotta move fast. Get her in the car!
No way you're outrunning me!
Get in the car, girl!
We're gonna have a talk.
Shit, man! I recognize this chick.
Got you now, bitch!
Somebody's gotta go! We gotta run! Listen! Listen to me! Marla kept her phone on that night. Filmed the whole thing! I just got a text with the video from Marla's phone!
I can see Lucinda on her front porch, looking across at us, her phone pressed to her ear.
You did this!
Who else did you send it to?
Please, Cerise, we gotta go!
Esteban and Trey are dragging me toward the car.
We're going, Nina. She's coming with us.
No!
Not again. I throw my head back with all my strength, and my foot comes up hard. And suddenly, I'm free.
Oh, for Christ's sake, I gotta do everything myself.
You best get your hands off that girl. I've already called the police.
Shit!
Alexa, come on now. Hurry.
I take off towards Lucinda's house.
I'm in! Go! No, wait for me! Esteban! Please!
Oh, shit! Shoo-shoo! Shit!
Stop! Hey, you stay right where you are, miss.
Shit! They blocked the damn intersection!
Just go! Go! Go!
Go where?
No reason to hold us. We didn't do nothing.
Yeah, right. Watch your head, kid.
That's all of them.
What happened to the other girl, ma'am? The one they were beating on?
I saw her run off behind the neighbor's house, officer. Probably a couple of streets away by now. Poor thing. I thought they might kill her.
Detective, you want to see this? Have a look at this kid's cell phone.
Jesus. Is that a hand coming out of that grave? What the hell's going on here? Careful. This is all a crime scene. We need you to stay behind the yellow tape until we're through here.
Sure, sure. So, you say you found the phone in the poor girl's own hand?
Yeah, it seems like everyone the girl knew got the same pictures and video. All sent from this phone. One of the kids is already spilling his guts, confessing. Only thing we can't figure out is who actually sent those texts.
Someone who wanted justice done, I guess.
I don't suppose you'd know anything about it, would you, Mr. Kellner? I'd like to thank our good Samaritan. It's not you, is it?
You kidding me, Detective? I'm too old for sneaking around.
You know, I've heard stories about a ghost in Dunhill Cemetery. You ever see anything like that?
Nope, can't say that I have. No, sir. All the ghosts in Dunhill Cemetery are at rest.
I'm sitting on the floor against the wall beneath the window in Lucinda's attic.
Calexa?
I'm here, Lucinda.
And I think it's time for us to talk.
I'd like that. I didn't know if you'd ever tell me how you ended up in the cemetery.
I guess I was afraid that if I talked about it, you'd have to do something about it.
Is that what this is? You're ready to change things?
I don't think so. Not yet. But I'm ready to trust someone. That isn't easy for me. Lucinda puts her hand on top of mine and smiles encouragingly.
Go on then, dear. Tell your story. I'll do all I can to be worthy of your trust.
The first thing I remember is dying.
By your own 3 days in the tomb.
Marla's memories are mostly faded now. Not gone exactly, but they no longer feel like my memories. But it isn't until the funeral that she leaves me.
Oh. Be careful there, miss.
A man next to me takes my arm to steady me. Thank you so much.
And don't mention it. Grief gets the better of us all sometimes.
Are you all right, dear?
I am, Lucinda. I'm fine. It's strange, but I'm gonna miss having her around. I feel kind of proprietary about seeing Marla finally laid to rest properly. After everyone except Mr. Kellner and his workers are gone, I linger unseen nearby. I've become quite the master of the unseen linger over the past few months.
Good work, boys. As soon as you finish with the sod, you can knock off for today. Why not get yourselves a drink on me?
That's nice of you, Tony. I know I could use a drink or two. The young ones are always hard.
Mr. Kellner is at the grave, his hat over his heart. I'm pretty sure he's saying prayer.
You can come out now, you know. I ain't gonna bite. Saw you at the funeral this morning with that old lady. I'm glad to see you made a friend. No? Not coming out? Okay, darling. Another day, then. But it might interest you to know I picked up an extra packet of those mint chocolate cookies that keep vanishing from my kitchen.
I do like those cookies. Or was it you who liked them, Marla? I guess I'll figure it out. Figure me out. The important thing is that I'm still here. Still above ground, drawing breath. For today, that's enough.
This has been a graphic audio production of Cemetery Girl Part 1, The Pretenders. Copyright 2014, Charlene Harris Incorporated and Christopher Golden. Doing business as Daring Greatly Corporation. All rights reserved. Recorded with the permission of the authors. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Production copyright 2014, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. With performances by Emlyn McFarland as Calexa, Nora Ashradi as Cerise, Dawn Ursula as Marla, Andy Brownstein as Mr. Kellner, Sherry Elliker as Lucinda, Nick DePinto as Esteban, Kenyatta Rogers as Willie, Kelly Knighton Huff as Lena, Jacob Ye as Trey, with David Harris, Tony Nam, Doug Brown, Drew Copas, Elizabeth Jernigan, John Dow, and Evan Casey. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Richard Rowan. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Cemetery Girl, be sure to look for the best-selling Brandon Sanderson series, Mistborn, produced in 5.1 surround sound and also available in stereo download and CD formats from graphicaudio.net.
The following is an interview with Cemetery Girl authors Charlene Harris and Christopher Golden and director Richard Rowan, conducted during the post-production process.
Hi, I'm Rick Rowan. I am the director and adapter for graphic audio of the new title Cemetery Girl, authored by Charlene Harris and Christopher Golden, who I'm happy to have on the phone with me today. Hi, guys.
How are you doing today?
Hi.
Good. Charlene is just back from what was supposed to be vacation in Great Britain, I believe, but turned into a little bit of a work vacation.
Almost any vacation is a work vacation. Actually, I went over to work in England for a week, and then my husband and I went on a cruise down the Danube and then the Rhine.
Wow. That sounds great. Yeah,
Chris. It was great.
Yeah,
that's where we should be conducting this interview, actually.
That sounds
yes.
good.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, perhaps in another life. at any rate, let's spend a little bit of time talking about your guys' respective careers. We'll start with you, Charlene. Of course, True Blood is in everybody's consciousness now, which was at least initially based on your work with the Sookie Stackhouse novels.
Yes, and I think the spiritual likeness remained.
Right.
Even though the factual likeness kind of went by the wayside.
Right. You had said at some point that you were perfectly okay with the interpretation of Sookie. It just wasn't your Sookie.
Well, yes. It was an interesting thing to watch, and I really enjoyed the whole process for the most part.
And you, of course, have been writing for quite a while now. You started out with more mystery-based work, I believe.
Yes, I did. And I still think of mystery as my home base.
Right. That makes sense. And Christopher is a noted author in his own right. Chris has done a lot of work. What is the current project that you would like to mention first that you've been working on?
Well, I think that the most recent one that people might find easily available is a novel called Snowblind that came out in January in hardcover and will be out in November in paperback.
Now, is that a solo work or is that part of a series? Or
yeah, no, it's a standalone solo horror novel, sort of supernatural thriller kind of thing that we're developing for TV right now with David Goyer.
Excellent. Interesting. Well, graphic audio listeners will note that Chris Golden was the author of Justice League of America Exterminators, which was one of the first DC Comics adaptations that we've done. So we have worked at least figuratively with Chris before.
Yeah, that feels like it was another lifetime, but it was awfully fun. I figured it was probably going to be my only opportunity to work with those characters, so I put in as many superheroes and DC characters as I could jam into one story.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a really good story. I mean, you've done a lot of adaptation work of working with other licensed properties. You've done work with Buffy stories.
I've done Buffy and X-Men and Hellboy and things like that. It's funny because I keep saying I'm going to stop doing it, and I think I really finally am going to stop doing it. But every time I say that, then I get offered something that the 15-year-old in me can't say no to.
Sure.
Most recently, I did a Sons of Anarchy novel that comes out in November of this year.
Wow. Is that more or less satisfying than coming working on stuff that you originate?
It's less, but to be honest, it's that thing where I really feel like there are two sides of my brain. You know, I mean, certainly doing my own original material is more satisfying from that creative sense, more rewarding artistically and usually financially. However, Again, I refer to that 15-year-old in my brain, and every once in a while something comes along that I know that if I could go back in time and tell the 15-year-old me that I was offered this and said no, the 15-year-old me would be so pissed. And that really is how I gauge some of this stuff. Like if I have to sort of be true to that. So.
Well, that sounds to me like a good way to go, a good code of decision-making, I guess. You guys both have illustrious enough careers that if people are interested, we can send them to specific websites on the internet. You guys want to tell us where the best way to get a hold of more material about you and your work would be? So maybe start with Charlaine?
Sure. I have a website, www.charlaineharris.com. I'm not afraid to be obvious. And then, of course, I have a professional Facebook page.
Excellent.
And I'm the same. I'm equally obvious. It's just ChristopherGolden.com. I'm on Facebook and also Twitter, but have yet to and probably will never expand, to the various multitude of other social media.
That's a full-time job in itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it is.
Now let's direct things towards the project at hand, which would be Cemetery Girl, which you have co-authored. Can you talk a little bit about how you guys got together on this?
Where were we, Chris?
We were at Dragon Con in Atlanta.
Dragon Con. We were at Dragon Con in Atlanta in the bar, which is, it's very typical for Chris, but not for me.
Hey, wait a minute. I don't drink at all.
The
bar at conventions is where all good things come to pass. But
it is. And we were talking about what we were going to do next, and I told Chris I had this sketchy idea, but it didn't seem like a novel to me, and I didn't really know what to do with it. And that was all that was said. I described the idea to him, girl living in cemetery, no memory. And then after a month or maybe two even, I got an email from Chris, and he said, had you ever thought about using that for a graphic novel? Of course I had not, because I had never written a graphic novel. I had no idea how to go about it. But we kicked the idea back and forth, and I finally thought, well, maybe I could do this if Chris would go in with me, because he's the guy who knows everything about graphic novels.
Well, I was really honored to be asked by Charlaine, obviously, and also, more importantly, to be, in on the ground floor of it, because, it was this thing where, we wanted to try to invent the story together. Charlaine had the background of who the character was and kind of where she was coming from and the basic setup of it. But we got to create these three stories for these three graphic novels together and to sort of flesh out her world. And I have to say, Charlaine, we talked about this before, but the thing that I admire most about Charlaine is the more something seems a little scary, the more interested in doing it she is. And a lot of times writers get, we get to rest on our laurels and not try new things. If there's the literary equivalent of bungee jumping, Charlaine's going to be first in line.
That's the only bungee jumping I'd be first in line for.
Well, me too. I'm not jumping off a bridge or anything. That's why we do what we do.
I like to shake things up. I think you can get too complacent.
Now, Chris, you had actually done graphic novels before, too. So, I mean, you had done, four or how many you had done?
I've actually been writing comics as long as I've been writing novels, which point is 20 years or so.
Oh, okay.
I've done comics off and on for years, but it's always been my moonlighting gig. Novels is my daytime job, and I moonlight writing comics. Probably the most substantial work that I've done aside from Cemetery Girl in comics is a series I do with Mike Mignola called Baltimore, which we do at Dark Horse Comics.
Ah.
And there are four volumes of that out now, and we're still going. So.
Sweet. All right. So now, Can you talk a little bit about the collaborative process? Did you literally just pitch ideas back and forth? Who put the script down, basically?
We both did. I mean, it's been sort of really fun. And again, that was part of the initial conversation, was that, Charlene and I both felt that we only were interested in doing this if she was going to be, writing comics, because that was sort of the bungee jump of being able to do that. And it's a weird medium. In fact, I've worked in such a variety of mediums, but it's actually it's the strictest medium, because you have to really work in a box. You're writing structurally something that is really limited. So we did. We plotted together on the phone, and then one of us would write one section and send it to the other, who would revise it and said, just like I've done in collaborations on novels, it's like tennis a little bit. You hit it back to the other person, and they fiddle with it a little bit and hit it back to you. So,
were there big surprises that for each other in terms of what you came up with?
I have such respect for Chris as a writer. I don't think he could do, any amazing thing, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, that's very kind. Listen, that's good Southern breeding right there.
Indeed.
It's always a surprise. It's always fun. We had the plots pretty well sort of structured, but we did make a number of sort of large changes along the way, and honestly, I don't remember, because they all come from these brainstorming conversations, where a lot of them came from. But I do know that, like, sometimes something will come back and I'll be like, oh, that's not what I thought we were doing, but that's great. And that's the beauty of working with somebody who's of like mind and whose work you really respect. I know that, like, the real secrets behind the main character changed from what we originally had envisioned. And it was funny because, again, like that one, that's really the main character's setup and everything is all from Charlene's brain.
Ah.
And so it was like, oh, that's who she is. Okay. All right. That's fine. And I love it, actually, And I'd love to see it take off and grow in other media and maybe have future stories, but you never know what'll happen. We're focused right now on the ones we're writing and not worried about the future.
Yeah, one of the things that about it being a graphic novel and what I think distinguishes it from other more action-based graphic novels is there is a heavy atmosphere there, which lends itself really well to audio, especially working in surround sound as we are on the project. That it's a moody piece. While there is interesting plot, it's not really plot driven, I wouldn't say, which is unusual for something in the graphic novel genre, I think.
And Charlene, do you want to talk about the setting and what gave you the inspiration for setting it there? And
sure, pretty much. I can capsule it in a sentence. I just love cemeteries. And I wanted to write a book set in a cemetery, and I thought, well, why would anybody live in a cemetery? And it would have to be because you couldn't live anywhere else, really, unless you wanted to go into supernatural reasons, and I didn't really want to. So it just kind of all evolved from that basic thing. I like cemeteries. I want to write about cemeteries. And that's just how it all evolved.
And then we had, just the fact that it's set in a cemetery, and we wanted to take advantage of the atmosphere, sort of helped us or guided us in choosing Don Kramer as the artist, because we knew that he would be able to pull off the kind of mood that we were looking for. But I think the other thing that contributes to what you're talking about is that if we'd done this as individual floppy comics, 22 page, monthly comic book, you have to sort of have every issue have its own beginning, middle, and an end.
Right.
And it really is the difference between doing television and doing a motion picture. So by doing it as an original graphic novel, instead of doing it as individual comics, we don't have to worry about the false structure of creating a beginning, middle, and end every 22 pages. Right. We could really spread out and breathe and let Dawn breathe with creating that atmosphere.
Yeah, of course, it's such a visual medium. There's a lot of information communicated in subtly rendered drawings. The artwork in the original graphic novel is terrific.
And that's the challenge for you guys, to try to paint it in your own audio fashion.
It is. It is indeed. But it's very helpful. We've learned from working with other material that has a strong visual reference, working with adaptations of the DC and Marvel properties, that to use that as a resource and as a reference to interpret that in sound in unique and interesting ways. Some of the adaptation, of course, of the script, we turned our audio script into a stronger narrative input from the character of Calexa than was necessary for the graphic novel, because in audio, the Calexa kind of has to tell us a little bit more of what's going on, whereas in the graphic novel, it's displayed visually.
Of course.
Speaking of Calexa, I know how the character derives her name in the course of the story, but where did it come from, you guys? Where did the Calexa name come from?
Jane's head, like Zeus giving birth to...
It did. I literally woke up one night, which is very not typical for me, but I woke up and I thought, her name is Calexa Rose Dunhill.
Wow.
I thought, okay, that's her name.
Interesting. And do you keep a pad by your bed that you scrawl down ideas that come to you in a dream state?
No. That was really unusual for me. I'm not one of these people who wakes up and thinks anything beyond, gee, I need to use some chapstick or or something like that.
Well, I'm really glad her name wasn't, gee, I need to use some chapstick.
That would have been cumbersome.
That's great. Well, let's see. What can we talk about in the plotting of? I mean, because so much of character of Calexa is very much starting from scratch with her own story, in the same way that the listener is or the reader is. So there's
that's exactly what the story's about. I mean, from the beginning when we talked about it, we talked about how we wanted to really make the focus about identity and how she not only has to build her own identity, absent any memory of her identity, she has to kind of figure out who she is and build who she is. And kind of, be honest, I feel like in life, even though we have our memories, we all get to do that. If we can, take our life by the reins, we can really create ourselves. And she's doing that on a regular basis. But her problem, of course, is that she doesn't know who to trust with who she is.
Right. But there definitely is a journey, even in the first part, of her character overcoming her own fear. She proves to be, while she doesn't really know herself, she discovers things about herself in the story, such as why she knows Latin, which is still a mystery, hopefully to be revealed. But she discovers, as we all do, her own inner strength at times, and can surprise herself with who she is without knowing it. I'm not sure if that's a question.
Okay. I can't rebut that.
Yeah. No, I think that she's, she's an interesting character because she is doing this building. She's finding this strength. And that's actually sort of my favorite thing about her. I mean, I guess the other thing plot-wise that I find interesting, and maybe Charlene wants to cover this, is that when we originally sort of came up with this, there wasn't really a sort of paranormal element, or not much of one,
right?
And then we kind of went back and forth on it, and I don't know, Charlene, do you want to talk about that?
We kicked that back and forth quite a bit. At first I was really against having any paranormal element, because I thought, I'm tired of being paranormal girl. I wanted to write something absolutely straight. And then I thought, well, is there any way to write this without and have her fully fleshed out as a character and show her fears? And after a lot of discussion, we ended up deciding that that element should be included. And I think it was Chris's idea to have her temporarily possessed by the spirits of people who are passing on, which is a strange idea, I think, and probably hard for Don to depict, though I think he's done a great job. Oh, but yeah. It really pays off in the third book in a major way, and that I totally did not expect. And I don't know if Chris did or not, but it works wonderfully.
Well, here's something I want to ask you guys, and if you're not ready to deliver this information, we can edit it out of the interview. But what about the release dates of part two and part three? Do you guys have
here's what I can tell you. What I can tell you is that Dawn is about 18 pages away from finishing book two, so excellent. I'm sure that we will have an announced release date soon.
Good.
And Charlaine and I are about 10 pages away from finishing the script for part three. So by the time Don is finished with part two, we'll be ready for him to start part three.
Excellent. Okay, good. So good. We are on a timetable here, plot
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
We were hoping that they'd be a year apart. It may be that it's slightly more than a year between one and two, but it'll be close.
Yes. That works. A lot of series that are turned into graphic novels after a run of a year or so, you know, I mean, it works within that formatting. One of the things that you had brought up that I thought was very interesting, that the only supernatural element, even though we have teenagers attempting to implement supernatural elements, the only one who really successfully is in touch with something occult or otherworldly is Calexa. Even though we have ritual sacrifice taking place and all kinds of attempts on the part of the teenagers.
Yeah. Calexa is, to sort of follow up on what Charlaine was saying, I think the way that it worked out has been great, because since we really were telling this story about identity, it just brings into sharp focus her lack of a persona and memories and history when she's filled with the memories of other people.
And so
that really works, but it all hinges on this idea in the book, and since we're doing this behind the scenes thing, it all hinges on the idea in this first book that when she's dumped in the cemetery at the beginning, she is legitimately dead for a minute.
That is a little uncertain, and I'm sure intentionally so in the opening. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and also I'm reminded of the fact that Marla, she says that Calexa is like an empty house or something along those lines, that there's this big vacancy in there that she could fill in.
Yeah, there's a room. There's at least an empty room.
Yeah, which I find very intriguing to see where the story will go from that aspect.
Well, good. That's what we were hoping.
Excellent. Well, you succeeded. Was there any other aspects of the story that you guys would like to, I'm trying to think now, I'm kind of drawing a blank. Because at first I was thinking that we had to dance around the issue, but the fact that we can really talk about literal, the characters of the teen gang, the Pentagram gang or whatever.
The Pretenders.
The Pretenders, exactly, where the title derives from. Where did the chemistry of that come from? I know that it's a sort of an ethnic mix. That was one of the descriptions in the original script, and it certainly came through in the illustrations. Can you talk about them a little bit?
Well, of course, we wanted to give her. She has to have an enemy.
Right.
She has to have someone on the spot. She can't keep speculating about who did her in. There has to be some crisis at hand, and these kids who are her age but have had completely different life experiences provide that, and they're at loose ends, and they don't have a goal in their life, so this is their substitute, is this kind of aimless dabbling.
Yeah, it's funny. I imagine them in my mind as more of certainly not a gang per se.
Right.
Although we do see a gang in in the second book, there is a somewhat of a gang presence,
right?
But in the first book with the Pretenders, there are these sort of wandering lost suburban kids, you know, and
right.
I felt like in my mind it was a group like that who let things get carried away and
yep.
Went down a path that they shouldn't have gone down, and unfortunately stuff like that happens all too often. In this
yeah.
case, it was a little crazier than usual.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, and the whole thing leading to, leading up to what happens with Marla is something that you can envision and you see people in groups like this gathered around one person who might be a little bit more unhinged.
Right.
And, her friends don't realize how completely unhinged she is until they get to the point where it's too late.
Too late to do anything about it, right. Exactly.
Right.
And she has such a dominating will and her own psychopath nature enables her to lead them, basically, to become that, they're willing to be manipulated up to the point where as you say, it becomes too late to do anything else.
Yes, we've seen that too often in the news, I think.
Yeah.
For people should be able to accept that because we see it, sadly.
Well, the one of the things that struck me about that the kids seemed pretty darn real. The dialogue seems like, very natural. The interactions, it seemed grounded, and we like kids we would know, or kids that possibly you guys knew.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
It's funny because the more time goes by, the more, what we remember is really more of a story we've told ourselves than things that actually happened.
Sure.
But I like to think that I remember what it was like to be that age and what it was like to be irresponsible.
Yeah.
Not quite as irresponsible as they are, I
yeah.
hope. But, I definitely went and drank with my friends in places that I shouldn't have been.
Sure.
Did things that were stupid. But... never tried to summon a demon. I'm sure Charlene tried to summon demons, but I didn't.
I got my first kiss in a cemetery.
Oh.
See?
Well,
would
you like to talk about that, Charlene?
Not really.
And what is it about kids making out in cemeteries? I just,
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something about it. I think they feel like nobody will observe them in a cemetery, which
yeah,
is
yeah.
usually absolutely true.
Yep.
Nobody's watching but the ghosts.
Yep.
Nobody's watching but the ghosts.
And you feel so very much alive as a young teenager in a cemetery, I think.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's nothing as energizing as going to a funeral in a lot of ways.
Yeah, which is interesting.
I never thought about it that way.
Yeah,
that's actually, I'm glad you said that. That's one of my favorite things about the first book is how Calexa attends the funerals and, borrows clothing and things like that.
I love that part.
Yeah, me too. I really do. I love it. I love when she takes the coat from the limo driver. Or the hearse
driver. That's what I'd do.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just thought it was so, this idea of like, well, I've got nothing else to do, but I'm going
right.
to attend these funerals. It's just, I don't know. I just love that bit.
Yeah. If you're gonna...
Me too. I would do that in a heartbeat.
Well, one of the interesting things about her character is that after the initial fear of being in that environment, she gets pretty relaxed in it. It becomes her home, and it becomes that's what what a cemetery girl would be attending funerals as much as she could.
Yeah, well, I think we all become resigned to our circumstances when they're outside of our control. Once she decides that she cannot reveal herself for fear that whoever tried to kill her will find her and finish the job.
Exactly.
Then she decides she is stuck here and she might as well make the best of it. She has to make a life as best she can until her memory returns, whenever that might be. And we're not going to tell you when that might be.
No, we're not.
Of course not.
That is our secret.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I think we have summarized pretty well without getting too much more, especially since we're not going to find out anything more about the story or where it's going to go. I want to thank you guys for joining me and talking about the story. I have enjoyed and am enjoying working on it. We're in the post-production stage as we're recording
Great.
This. So you guys will be hearing something soon. And you can,
fantastic.
You know,
wonderful.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Charlaine Harris and Christopher Golden, and congratulations on Cemetery Girl, and we're looking forward to parts 2 and 3.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.